But the announcements, let us turn to Daniel and chapter 3. Daniel and chapter 3. We will read the first 7 verses, although really this story covers the whole chapter of Daniel. However, for today, I just want to limit myself to the first 7 verses as we think about the theme of bowing to Nebuchadnezzar's golden image. Bowing to Nebuchadnezzar's golden image. Daniel chapter 3 and verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Well, brethren, we return to a series of messages in the book of Daniel, and I'm glad to notice that we have a fair number of young people in our midst, because we are deliberately tailoring the series of messages in this book to the younger section of our church. Yes, even those who are older should be able to benefit and be challenged. However, as I sit down to prepare, in front of my own mind are those that I consider to still have the future in front of them, if you understand what I mean. Most of us now, most of our future sort of went past behind us before we could count up to 10. We are seeing that this book is about God's sovereignty and faithfulness rather than about Daniel. And one of the ways in which we see it is this same chapter that we are beginning to look at today. Daniel is not even mentioned at all in the whole chapter. But as you read it and meditate upon it, you soon see that again the theme of God's sovereignty, His highness, His control, and the theme of His faithfulness to His people comes to the fore. This book is about Daniel, rather about God. Last week, we saw the nature of skin-deep religion. And we saw it as primarily one which speaks about God, but really honors human beings, or the vague cells through which the truths of God come to bear upon human consciences. We saw that from the last section of Daniel chapter 2, when Nebuchadnezzar said the right words. When in verse 47 he said, "Truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." Wow! A person speaking like this, you would conclude, must truly be converted to our God. But no, this is skin deep religion. This is somebody who has been so affected by the immediate witness of God that he cannot help acknowledge something concerning this God. But when you look at everything else around him, you soon begin to see that he is still blind. His religion is still skin deep. It is all about fellow human beings, or the channel through which God reveals himself. And we saw that he fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel. He commanded that an offering, an incense, be offered up to Daniel. He promoted Daniel, honored him, and brought many gifts to him, and so on and so forth. It was all centered upon this vehicle, this physical and visible vehicle that God had used to reveal himself to Nebuchadnezzar. And that's how skin deep religion is. It's not about God. It's always about honoring these men of God, or honoring these vehicles like the buildings in which we meet, and giving that kind of superstitious honor and position to simply means, ordinary means that God uses to reveal himself to us. And so the appeal last week is that prominent people who are sincere and say the right things must never deceive you. You must never conclude too quickly that therefore they are Christians, because they pay some kind of lip service to the Christian faith. Listen carefully to who they really honor, whether it is God or the visible things that are there before them. Well, today we see the skin deep religion of Nebuchadnezzar for what it really is. I mean, he's just come back from having this meeting with Daniel that they've made you think, wow, here is a guy who has now been converted to Jehovah, to Yahweh. And the next thing he does is to make an idol. Now, clearly, that should tell you that this religion was not true. He is still what he was before, an idolater. But I also want us to see from this why God's sovereignty is always under attack. You see, Nebuchadnezzar here in this passage is simply a type of the world in which we are, and the world order in which we live. He's simply a type. He's simply showing in an example form that which is the reality in every age and in every part of the world. And it is that which is always in contrast to the rule and sovereignty of God. And indeed, as you look at this entire book of Daniel, that's what you see again and again. What you see there is two kingdoms at war. Babylon, representing the kingdom of this world, trying to show its might, trying to squash everything and every vestige of true religion in the people of Israel. And Israel, the kingdom of God, represented through Daniel and his friends. And clearly you can see that there is ongoing pressure upon the kingdom of God to yield itself to the kingdom of this world. Chapter after chapter, That's what you are constantly seeing, this play taking place. And friends, it did not end with the book of Daniel. It's the reality in which we all are. In our homes, in our workplaces, in our community generally, and in the world. These two kingdoms have locked horns. And if you are a true child of God, you can feel the pressure upon you. The pressure to yield to a kind of sovereignty of this world. Well, let's see something of this, especially in the first 7 verses of Daniel and chapter 3. One of the sad fruits of human total depravity is that the world is on a senseless ego trip. The world is, as it were, running headlong, refusing any form of caution to its finding satisfaction and fulfillment for its own passion. And that's what we find with Nebuchadnezzar. Look at verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, that's approximately 30 meters long, and its breadth 6 cubits, which is about 3 meters in height, rather in width. And he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, friends, you ask yourself the question, why did Nebuchadnezzar make this mammoth image of gold? I mean, here he is, as an individual, who has got a lot already to himself. To begin with, he has a god. You remember in chapter 1, he had taken the vessels from the Lord's temple and now put them in the little temple of his own god. He probably had wives and many wives and concubines for that matter. He had children, no doubt about it, many children. He had wealth. I mean, a guy who builds something that is 30 meters tall and at least 3 meters wide and it is made of gold must have a lot of gold to throw away. He had power. He had overcome nation after nation after nation to the point where his empire at this time was the greatest empire on the planet, Babylon. And yet, the thing about fallen nature is this, it is never satisfied. Never. It must go on gobbling in more things, gobbling in more things, gobbling in more things. And here he is now, with all these. And what does he do? Come up with a major image that is made of gold. Where on earth could this have come from? Well, there's a possibility that it was the dream that he just had in chapter 2. The dream that he just had in chapter 2. Listen to verse 31. This is Daniel telling him what he saw. Daniel chapter 2 and verse 31. You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold. Its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So here he was, he dreamt this, and it sort of made him go, wow, what on earth is this? Well, later on he is told what it was all about. But you know what? He still continued sitting there thinking, you know what? It would be a bad idea to really make something like that. Something that made me go, wow, should be able to make everybody in my empire go, wow. And consequently, he threw himself into this expedition, into this adventure, and poured a lot of money into this. And sure enough, we are told he set it up in a plane. Now, the plane that he set it up for was such that it was visible from long distances. And consequently, as it was there, 30 meters high, and the sun, either because it is rising or because it is setting, would invariably cause it to shine in all that gold, sparkling light taking place from there. The consequence of it, obviously, is that people would be saying, wow, what on earth is that? He put it there. Now, you still ask yourself, what benefit was this thing going to be? What benefit? And friends, even today, I'll be coming in a moment to one or two examples of this. Look at what the world spends so much energy on. And often, when you pause for a moment and ask yourself, what real benefit is this going to be to the world, to people, to God's world? What real benefit? And yet a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of talent, a lot of energy is poured simply because somebody who is in control wants to expand that passion that is still within him. Sadly, for many of us, we still go, wow, wow. Instead of asking the question, how is this going to benefit anybody? How? But you see, the world's ego trip in seeking to satisfy the passion is not satisfied until fellow human beings come and see. Until fellow human beings come and go, wow, this is great, this is glorious. Therefore, this guy is great, he's glorious. And that's what happened here. Look at verse 2 to verse 3. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, you can see Daniel deliberately wants to show you that they all came. Eh? So just repeats the same, the previous sentence. The satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Nebuchadnezzar summoned his top brass from all the corners of his empire to come and inaugurate this image. So one day, there it was. And I don't know what cloth they used to cover it, first of all. And then he said to his guys, get horses, send messages to all the provinces. All the top brass must come. And he was there imagining how it was going to be on that particular day. The point I want to mention here, again, is imagine the waste of resources involved in this. To do what? To come and see. You know what it means? Just in Zambia, if you were to bring to Lusaka all the ministers, provincial ministers, all the cabinet ministers, all the magistrates and justices and all the mayors and all the district commissioners and all that, you know, sort of bring everybody. Usually they don't just come alone at their own cost. It's, again, it's a lot of taxpayers' money with a lot of individuals, and when they come into Lusaka, they are not going to be hiding in relatives' homes and so on. No. It's all in these 5-star hotels. A lot of resources were wasted on this occasion. To do what? To come and see. That's all. To come and stand and go, wow. And start going back again. But you see, it's the ego wanting to be satisfied. It's not enough that I've done this. I need everybody to see that I've done this. So that as they go away, they are saying, you know what? This king is great. This king is glorious. He is the most mighty. Look at what he has done. The ego trip. And so the day arrives, and they are there, as we saw. And finally, this thing is unveiled. And of course, they must have gone, wow. And after the wow, obviously start looking at one another saying, is this all? I mean, let's face it, friends. This was utterly stupid, except that it is the king who's demanding it. Because there's work to be done. Real work. You are governing people. There are cases that you are looking after and dealing with. People want justice to be done, and you've been taken out of all your seats. People are now waiting there just so that you can come and go, wow. But sadly, that's what the world is about. It's about this human pursuit to satisfy passion. And the person at the top is the one who now gravitates all that passion towards him. Whether it is in the home, or whether it is in the workplace, or whether it's in the community or in the nation, it's all bam. Attention there. And sadly, to get this attention, that's what the media has been reduced to. The media has been reduced to nothing more than following big people in their passion to prop up their ego. You can take today's newspaper with its perhaps 20 pages and you can reduce it to 2 pages of real news. The rest of it is about people just making noise about nothing. President so-and-so said. Well, guess what? He didn't even write that speech. Doesn't even know what was put there. Other people did it. It's all just an act to fulfill the opportunity. Real, real stuff is not there. And those of you who are Christians and revolve in what I call higher places in society, I'm sure you know what I'm speaking about. You sit through events that take the whole day, you've been caused to leave important work to go there, and by the end of the day, you're asking yourself the question, what was that all about? There was nothing. Nothing. Except propping up human egos. Human beings wanting attention about nothing. Sadly, the world's ego trip often turns into demands for blind obedience. Into demands from blind obedience. And this is what happened to these people. Look, they've been called to come and, what are we told here? They've been summoned to come and inaugurate this image that he has put together. That's what he called them to come and do. End of verse 3. And all the, verse 2. And all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image. The dedication. Okay? Sounds interesting. Let's go and see. But upon getting there, listen to the announcement. In verse 4. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up." And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Initially, it was just supposed to be that I'm there and I go, "Wow, this thing is huge, it's big, it's glittering. I've never seen anything like this." That's not enough. The world's agenda finally goes one step further, and it is this: I must be seen to be sovereign over all of you. I must be seen to be in the place of God in your lives. And consequently, this wow became ouch. Yeah, became ouch. Because suddenly, as they heard this announcement, they must have begun to look at one another and say, "Mwana, tulachitasha. Yeah, what shall we do now? We are already here. We are staring this thing in the face." I mean, when people bow down and you don't bow down, you know what happens, eh? You can easily be singled out. At least if you are all already lying down and then you've just been told that you should say amen, you can keep quiet. But here you are standing before this image and you are being good. And these people knew, as we shall see towards the end of this chapter, that these tyrants, when they said they will throw you into fire, they actually threw you into fire if you didn't do what they said. It's not like our kings today who sort of offer all kinds of threats and then tomorrow morning they wake up and say, "What did I say?" and change their minds. It becomes a power play. And many people, even today, feel the pressure from the top. Suddenly the boss, the parent, or whatever it is, makes a demand that only God should place upon us. And suddenly, you are not allowed. If you don't do, you are fired. And sure enough, you know there have been people that have not done, and sure enough, they've been kicked out. You know that. They are there in your community. Now, most of us, it's not our lives that are in danger today when I speak about this pressure. Although, when you think in terms of militant Islam, that's what's happening. First of all, they tell you, you know, Muhammad is great, the great prophet, and so on, you know, believe in him, the great prophet. Some of you do, others don't. The next time they come, those of you who don't, put grenades under your seats and blow you into splinters. Suddenly, it is terrorism. And there's messages that are clear in the newspapers every day. Churches being burnt, individuals being killed, universities being slaughtered, university students being slaughtered in their hundreds, school girls being abducted in their hundreds. And what's the message? It is suddenly you must bow and worship. We're not going to reason with you. It's now a power play. You must bow down and worship. But as I said, most of us may be very far from that. But still, the pressure is unmistakable when it comes to this agenda. Think for a moment about the homosexual issue in America. The issue there has not been that they will put bombs under your seat. It's been what they call legal action. Twist a few arms, put a bit of money here, there, and before long, justices are passing laws that obviously don't make sense. And initially the idea is, again, you know, it's just our rights. We don't want to push anybody. It's just about us also. Us also. Us also. But before you know it, again, this pressure is unmistakable. It doesn't end. Pastor friends in America are suffering because these guys are now going to them and they are saying, marry us. Deliberately earmarking them and going and saying, marry us this weekend. And when they don't do it, legal action by Monday. And that legal action is saying, you know, I must be paid $200,000 because I was traumatized, I was made to feel less human, I was, you know, indignified and everything else. $200,000. They are feeling the pressure. They are feeling the pressure. I'm sure you read of that couple that these guys went to and said, beg for us. And when they said, sorry, our consciences are not clear about baking wedding cakes for homosexuals, legal action. And they are demanding a fortune out of this young couple. A fortune! You must bow to us. It just turned around just like that. At one time, we're sort of watching it at a distance, saying, before we know it, the whole thing is saying, bow down. Before we know it. And even in Zambia, people in the NGO world are losing their jobs. I know of at least one of our members who resigned, primarily because the message was clear. You either support the homosexual agenda or we don't support, we don't finance the NGO. What can he do? He tried to argue with management,
Management said, look, we've got children to feed Iwe. Eh? So in the end, he just tendered in his resignation and wrote to me and said, Pastor, pray for my family because I now have to start looking for a job. It's pushing. It's pushing. It's pushing. What is even worse is the fact that the general response of the world to this pushing, this pressure, is blind obedience. Sadly, it's blind obedience. Look at verse 7. Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. That's how the top brass of Babylon responded. Now, brethren, these were very educated individuals. Highly educated. They are standing there. They've left very important work. They are now being asked to look at a piece of metal. And obviously, to begin with, yes, they were quite surprised at how big this piece of metal was. And they may have looked at each other and said, yeah, this guy has a lot of money. Hey, wow! The next moment, they hear in the loudspeaker that they must yield their wills to this piece of metal. And they probably looked at each other and said, bah, Mwana, what shall we do now? Then the sound was heard. And at that moment, obviously, sort of looking at one another and going down slowly and finally lying down with everybody else. Educated people with brains. With children at home. Who could have known better? There's a story that was written many years ago called the Emperor's Clothes or The Emperor Has No Clothes, whatever the title you prefer. And it was a story that was meant to make mockery of this attitude by big people. And the story had it that some clever guys came to the king and said that they could make clothes which can only be seen by clever people. Foolish people can't see this clothing. So of course the king was quite impressed about it and got them into one of his rooms, and they were there with their sewing machines making this nice robe. But there was actually nothing there. But whenever the king would pass through, they would look very busy, you know. And one would say, yeah, it's really coming out very nice, coming out very nice. And the king, when he would be asked, would also say, yeah, it's, you know, wonderful, wonderful, and so on. And, you know, finally the day came when the king had to put on these clothes and he was robed in them. Apparently, and the guys were really waiting on him with pins in their mouths, you know, pretending to be hooking here, there, and so on. Finally, they looked back and said, wow! And they called out the satraps and prefects and governors and so on. And said, look, look! How's the king looking? That was an emperor. How's the emperor looking? And wow, it's looking great, looking great. So finally, they called the whole city to come and see the king's clothing. And as the king was going out, and of course, word had already done its rounds that only fools won't see it. So, of course, nobody wants to be called a fool. So, as the king was coming, passing through, everybody, when they'd be asked, I was like, oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Until a kid, a child, passing through the legs of big people, suddenly shouted and said, hey, the emperor has no clothes. That's when the emperor went like this and dashed into hiding. Often that's what happens in the world. It's obvious to everybody that we can't be bowing to this thing. Then why do we do it? Why did they do it? Well, at least there are three reasons I can quickly give. The first was that they were already idolaters. They already had their gods made of metal or wood or whatever else it might be. So they were already used to bowing down to lifeless things. There's another reason, and it is because they followed the crowd. They followed the crowd. You can imagine all these people, this top brass, bowing to this nothing. Look, you follow the crowd. That's what everybody's doing. That's what everybody's doing. And consequently, they did it as well. And then lastly, they feared the king. It was out of fear. Their lives would be in danger, and therefore they did it. Friends, sadly, that's the world we are in today. Men and women know that half of what is happening in our world, the agenda of this world, is being dictated by some people somewhere. It is senseless, but what can we do? And consequently, they are following after it. Following after it. Following after it. And this is the world that we are in. And that's why being a Christian makes us to be its enemies. Think, for example, of just one idol of our own day, and it's what has been handsomely called human rights. It is an idol that we are called to look at. Human rights. And nobody wants to ask the question, who came up with them? Where did they come from? Rather, it's a stick that is used to just beat you on the head. Human rights. Same thing, human rights. And in the name of this idol, millions of babies have been slaughtered in their mother's wombs. Millions. And you know what it's called? It's the right of the mother. The right of the mother. Millions. Nobody's answering the question or asking the obvious. Most people have an abortion because they are ashamed. They feel pregnant. And it was out of a sexual affair that was outside marriage. It's obvious. But no, no, no. That won't be brought up. No, 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 no. That's moral judgment. No, 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 no. It's human rights. And when you are in a meeting and you try and speak like that, they literally shout you down. Consequently, it's the crowd. It's everybody's doing it. You dare not speak. Under human rights, homosexuality has come out of the dark shadows. Under so-called human rights, homosexuals march through the streets. Men kissing men in public, women kissing women in public. It's a golden image. You dare not touch it. I've already spoken about how the pressure is coming upon God's people, Christians. Real pressure. Real pressure. To bow to Nebuchadnezzar's image. And you see, the thing that differentiates Christianity from all this, even in human rights, is that Christianity is absorbed with the sovereignty of God above all things. In other words, even human rights, we bring it under God because God is supreme. And consequently, we begin to understand it this way. That if human rights will go against what God has said, then it is not human rights, it is human rebellion. Straight and simple. God is supreme. Now friends, I want to assure you, the world won't hear that. It won't. But also, the Christian faith is reasonable. It is sin which is unreasonable. The Christian faith is reasonable. It lets us know that there is a creator, that this thing we are seeing was designed by someone. And obviously, the way he designed it means that there is something that he wants to come out of it. So that's where we always begin in our reason. We begin from God and we begin God down. And we think through things. I've asked our media people to throw a picture on the screen. I hope they have it now. All right, thank you very much. Now, most of you know I have an interest in birds. That's a sandbird, by the way. It's one of those birds you always find around your flowers, with a long beak going in to pull out nectar, which it then turns into food or sugars and gives to its babies, and it enjoys itself. The thing that always strikes you there is the beauty of that little thing. The beauty. You rarely have the opportunity to see it up close like that. But look at the colors. Amazing. Now, for someone to come and tell you that that came from a bang, you know, it just sort of bang. Thank you for laughing. Because you obviously feel that somebody must have designed that, isn't it? I mean, it's beautiful. A bang doesn't produce things that beautiful. So the Christian faith goes back to the designer and says, what did the chief designer of the planet, of the galaxy, of the universe, what did he design this for? He must have had some purpose. There was some deliberateness. He didn't just throw colors together haphazardly. Look at the beauty that's coming from there. The way in which the feathers are flowing from the beak going backwards. Smaller ones near the beak. Bigger ones as you're going over the head, going downwards. Wow! There must be a creator. It causes me to worship him. Christianity is reasonable. It doesn't just say what is the right of the mother, it also says, what is the right of the baby in the mother's womb? Isn't the womb meant to be a place of protection? Real protection? Until the baby is old enough to manage the harshness of the world out there? How then can we take a knife or a scissors or whatever it is in the place that God has put in the center of a mother's life and go and cut into pieces that human life because it cannot speak? How? That's what the Christian faith asks. We refuse to just bow. We ask questions. There's a designer. We ask questions about human biology. We say, but how can a man have sex with a man? Please tell me. And they say, shut up. No, but I'm asking. Because Christianity is reasonable. It asks the question, how? It asks the question, why? It asks those questions. Nebuchadnezzar, why have you made this high, long image of gold? Why? Why have you asked us to leave our offices to come here and look at a piece of metal? Why? Why do you want us to bow down to this thing? Why? Give a reason. Don't just say because I'm a king and consequently you should do it. Answer me. Answer me. That's the Christian faith. And often you will find that it is sin that is unreasonable. When a person wants to continue in sin, whether it's failing in terms of sexual relations in a marriage and consequently having women all over the place, you will often find that when you ask the question, the basic question, why? How come? Let's reason together. You find that they've got no reason whatsoever. It's the passion. It's the passion. It's the ego that still wants to have full vent. Human rights. I mean, it's in these rights that we're now having women walking around half naked. On my way home today, we had no power, so I had to park at Kablonga to get some pizza. And, you know, you have to wait for about 15, 20 minutes for these things. And, you know, women were passing in front of me that, yeah, sort of keep looking down, you know, keep looking down. You're thinking, but, you know, these are adults. Eh? You mean they don't know that they are half naked? Should I go out of my car and say, Vamayo? Tamufuele. You know, should I do that? Didn't they know it when they were leaving home that I'm half naked? But again, of course, if you try to do that, it's my right. It's my right. Who are you to tell me how I dress? It's my right. No, I'm not telling you how you dress. I'm telling you how undressed you are. That's what I'm doing. But we must bow to Nebuchadnezzar's image. That's the pressure. That's the pressure on us. We must bow to Nebuchadnezzar's image. But as Christians, and that's what we will see, the Lord willing, next week or the week after, is that as Christians we must refuse. We must refuse. We know better. We must refuse. We know there is a sovereign God in the universe. And if we protect us as we take our stand, praise be to God. If he doesn't protect us and we lose our jobs and as a consequence we suffer, praise be to God. He is sovereign. We owe him our worship. That's it. And in the meantime, while the pressure builds, we must continue saying to God, God, help us. God, guide us. God, lead us. As the
onslaught of the kingdom of this world continues upon us as your people. The madness of this world continues to be poured upon this world. Oh, guide me, O thou great Jehovah, as I make my way through this barren land. Help me, until you bring me to glory. Sin has made human beings mad. Let's not follow them in that madness. Let's follow our God, and may He guide us to glory. Amen.